Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And we've been out for a little while, on and off. I know you took some special time for the Jewish New Year, and glad to have you back.
Well, it's great to be back, and you've had real experiences. You've been traveling and working. Where did you go, Christy?
Well, my husband and I, and we actually took the kids with us, with our church, went to Kenya to do some medical mission work. The ministry we've been involved in there for about 10 years. So it was a great experience to be there and to be with our children in that service.
Well, maybe you'll write a little bit of a blog and share some of your experiences. I know Your Health listeners and I as well would love to hear about it.
Well, I look forward to sharing it. But on our show today, we've got a lot of exciting things to talk about. We're going to talk with Dr. Ethan Bosch, Director of Patient Outcomes at UNC Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center, about drug labels. Could they tell us more?
And the short answer is, you betcha. But we'll find out a lot more, and I'm really looking forward to that conversation. And we've got some really interesting research that matters today, Christy, about osteoporosis in men.
About germs in your lipstick.
Your lipstick. About autism and Spanish tests for it among our Hispanic population.
And finally, about exercise and its relationship to endometrial cancer risk.
Well, let's really talk about this very first research that matters, Christy, about osteoporosis risk among men. Because we don't think about, even as a male doctor, I don't really think about this very often among my male patients, and perhaps I should.
Well, it's not as common in men, which is why we don't think about it as much. And there hasn't been a standard way to screen men because it's not as common and we can't just test everyone for something that's relatively rare. But there is this test called the Male Osteoporosis Risk Estimation Score that doctors can use. It's also called the MORES score, M-O-R-E-S, that doctors can use to help guide patients of whether they should be screened.
And in this particular study that was in the Journal of the American Board of Family Practice, researchers from Texas looked at 346 men who completed this study and looked at those that had osteoporosis of the hip. It turned out a little under 5% had that, and looked at how well this MORES, the screening test for osteoporosis among these men, would have helped predict those that who needed screening that could have identified this osteoporosis.
And so looking at things like age, weight, if a person has chronic lung disease, those things go into the MORE score. And if a person in the study, if the people who were screened with this MORES process yielded the number needed to screen to prevent one fracture was 259 compared with 636 if you screened everyone. So you can
pare it down. And I looked at their algorithm, that the criteria they came up with to figure it out. And it's really pretty simple, which is basically if you're a male that's older, particularly over the age of 75, if you weigh less than about 150 pounds, you're pretty thin as a male. And if you smoke, you certainly need to be screened. Those three risk factors really highlight a really large at-risk group. So if you're any of our listeners out there, if you have parents or loved ones that really fit those criteria, or at least even two of those three criteria, you definitely should talk with your doctor about getting a screen for osteoporosis.
Absolutely. So let's talk about our next research that matters, about danger lurking in, not your lipstick, Adam, but those of you listeners out there who wear lipstick, in your lipstick. Are there dangers and germs or metals in your lipstick?
Well, when I first heard about this study, Christy, I thought, is this a really big issue? I do know that a lot of women, and perhaps some men, do wear lip balm and lipstick. And then I started thinking about, well, you see women reapplying their lipstick several times during a day. You see licking the lips a lot of times. And I thought, well, I wonder if there are things perhaps in this lipstick that potentially are toxic. And it turns out, I'm a little concerned. What do you think?
Well, I think it there is some evidence now to show that there are traces of lead, traces of aluminum, chromium, manganese that are inside lipsticks. And it's fairly common, but that the amount of this is pretty low. And these metals are everywhere. And we don't have anything to tie that to then heavy burden in women's bodies or cancer risk or other bad outcomes. So I think it's concerning that we need to pay attention to it, but it didn't freak me out so much that I won't put on lipstick. I don't wear it every day anyway, so.
And I don't know if I am freaked out by it, but I am concerned. This was actually in a journal, Environmental Health Perspectives, and they did find these traces of these metals, including lead, which there is no safe threshold for lead. And so any amount is considered things you want to avoid. And aluminum, for instance, is added to lipsticks as a stabilizer. So I think this is, you know, one of those things where if you can get organic lipsticks or things that we know are less likely to be toxic, that might be better. And just certainly don't swallow after licking the lips. And I don't know. I'm just keeping my antenna up. And certainly I'm not going to advise not to. But I think maybe we'll put a link up and let our listeners at least take a look at the data.
I think so, too. A lot of the articles about this are called A Poison Kiss or Danger Lurking in Your Lipstick.
You think those were potentially biased statements, Christy? Come now.
I think it's a little funny. Okay, let's keep going.
Our next research, not funny at all. And it really has to do with this test for autism and the fact that many primary care doctors, pediatricians, don't offer a screening test in Spanish for autism for their Hispanic patients. I found this actually upsetting.
I found it upsetting as well. So this was a study surveying 267 California pediatricians to find out, you know, what percentage of them offer Spanish developmental tests and also autism spectrum disorder tests. So there are standard times at which we are recommended to screen our patients for this by the American Academy of Pediatrics. And it ideally, these tests should be done in the native language of the parents.
This article was published in the journal Pediatrics, and they even found that the pediatricians who had a patient population that was over 25% Latino still said they had a difficult time recognizing these autism symptoms in Spanish-speaking children. So this tells me that we really need to do a better job, maybe starting in our own practice, Christy, of looking at how are we screening our Latino patients and educating our providers to look for autism, because it tends to be a much longer delay in diagnosing autism in our Latino patients. That's not acceptable.
And we know that early diagnosis can be helpful if people get the resources they need. I'll tell you, Adam, we do have ours in Spanish.
Let's go for it. Our very last research that matters, exercise can reduce the risk of endometrial cancer risk in women. I think this is an important study and one that we're glad to bring to our listeners.
I do too. We have evidence that exercise can reduce breast cancer risk. And in this study, they looked at that in endometrial cancer. And they found some discrepancy in that people who are already overweight and obese were able to reduce their risk by getting plenty of exercise. But it didn't seem to make a difference for people who were already at normal weight.
So certainly, and the mechanisms make sense to reduce circulating estrogens with weight loss and physical activity. This was in the British Journal of Cancer. Pretty straightforward. Another benefit of exercise, reducing risk, improving overall health.
So just to review, we've talked a little bit about reducing your risk of endometrial cancer if you're a heavy woman and you're exercising.
About talking with your doctor and doctors talking with their colleagues about offering Spanish tests and autism risk for their Latino patients.
About some possible dangers to what's contained in your lipstick and needing to pay attention to that.
And simple tests to identify men who should have a screening test for osteoporosis.
That concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. Adam and I are going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Ethan Bash, Director of Patient Outcomes at the UNC Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center, about cancer drug labels. Could they tell us more? You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we have the pleasure of talking with Dr. Ethan Bash, Director of Patient Outcomes at UNC Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Care, about drug labels and cancer. Can they or even should they tell us more? Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Bash.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
I wonder if you'd share with us a little bit about what drew you into cancer medicine, and in particular, what led you to focus on patient-centeredness with respect to medicines?
Sure. Well, I have a longstanding interest in cancer care from very early in my career. That was because when I was training, I found it to be a very meaningful area where, as a clinician, I could form very deep relationships with patients and also have an impact on their lives at a very difficult time in many cases. Also, the research was extremely interesting in cancer care. As far as patient-centered outcomes and patient-reported outcomes, which were areas I've become involved with that we can talk about a little bit, it became apparent to me pretty quickly as a physician that although we're all very well-intentioned, unfortunately, often we don't communicate as well with our patients as we might. A lot of our patients' questions go unanswered, but most notably, in research, we don't always understand how patients are feeling as well as we could. And as a result, when we analyze the results of research, we have often an inaccurate understanding of how patients have done with a particular treatment in that research.
So help us to understand, and I know we want to talk a lot about this whole topic, and you just had a publication and talking about this in the New England Journal of Medicine we want to talk about, but give us an example, if you could, about what do you mean when we don't communicate as well with cancer patients about things that they may find meaningful? Give us an example.
Sure. Well, there was a study just this past year that asked patients and asked their cancer doctors what they thought the goals of care were. Very simple question. And these were in patients who sadly had very advanced incurable cancer. And more than half of the patients who had just come out of the office said that they believed that the goal of care was to cure their cancer. And when they asked the doctors what the goal was comfort care because the cancer is incurable. And this is a problem for a number of reasons. The first is obviously it points to a communication disconnect. And it's obviously not clear where that disconnect is or, you know, maybe something was discussed but it was forgotten or not clear. Regardless of why it happens, those patients may be making very important decisions about their care based on an incorrect assumption about the goals of the care.
The other piece of this with medications, and as you know, it's very complicated. And I'm sure if you started using the words you use routinely with your colleagues, none of us would understand a lot of the details of how medicines work and what the research shows. And if you have a patient coming to you who's nervous and scared for the big C word, I imagine there are lots of opportunities to miscommunicate what the purpose of the medicine or the hope or the reality of the medicine is. How do you work through that?
I think that's absolutely true. I think that especially those early meetings when a person has a new diagnosis of a cancer and they come to talk to a doctor or a nurse, there's so much new information. There can be many frightening details, a lot of technicalities, and it's often hard to remember all of that. Often we recommend that people come with someone, a companion, either a family member or a friend who can help. We often recommend writing things down, scribing. I've had patients ask if they can record our meetings, which I'm always fine with. But regardless of all of that, I think it's sometimes very difficult. And we as physicians are often not trained in this area. We're often not taught how to talk to patients, how to communicate well, how to pause and make sure that a person understands what you've said, to ask them to repeat it back or to ask them to acknowledge that they understand. And, you know, this is increasingly acknowledged as a problem in how care is delivered. And it's actually an area where there's quite a bit of research going on now.
We're talking with Dr. Ethan Bash, oncologist at the University of North Carolina and the Leinberger Cancer Center, about his appreciation and thoughts about the patient experiences as it relates to cancer care and new drug development. And Dr. Bash, you put this article in the New England Journal of Medicine, really putting out there this belief that the Food and Drug Administration, and I guess many of us in medicine, pay too little attention to the patient experience, particularly in the development of new drugs. Tell us a little bit about how that is important to you and important to patients.
Sure. Well, the article itself really speaks to a very specific area in how new drugs are developed, but it is representative of a much broader issue in medicine. The piece itself is about how, when very large studies are done, clinical trials to study new drugs, that often are going on in many different countries and many thousands of people simultaneously, we don't actually ask people how they're feeling most of the time. These are drugs that are given to people who may have many symptoms related to their cancer, fatigue, pain, difficulty sleeping, difficulty with their quality of life, interference with their activities. But also the drugs are often quite toxic and can cause nausea. They can cause numbness and tingling in the fingers and toes and many other side effects. And so these drugs have a tremendous impact on how people feel and how they live their daily lives. But surprisingly, it is very rare that we rigorously ask people about these things. We are more interested in things like survival, which is extremely important. We're interested in some of the blood tests and some of the scans that we do. But we don't ask the simple questions about how people are feeling. And as a result, when the Food and Drug Administration or other regulatory authorities around the world begin to look at whether it's worth it to approve a drug, if the risk is worth it for the purported benefit, we're missing a lot of information. And the missing information is about how patients feel. And the reason I think that this is representative of a broader trend in healthcare is because there are actually many, many contexts in healthcare outside of drug development where it would benefit us to ask patients how they're feeling in order to inform the way that we do things. But unfortunately, we don't do that right now.
A radical concept.
It is, right?
Well, and the other elements of perhaps incomplete information about what their prognosis will be and how this medication is proven or not proven to change that, the cost of the medicine, and how they're going to feel on it. I mean, these are complicated things to be addressing, especially if we as physicians don't have all the information, and then we're guiding patients who only have their one experience, their life experience, and their hope to draw from. I imagine you need several hours to be with each patient to work through some of these things.
Well, you know, in the setting of a study or a clinical trial, a lot of these things can be found out through quite simple questionnaires. And in the case of clinical care, when I see patients, I want to have that information from those trials at my disposal so I can inform them about what they might expect to feel, or if they're feeling something with the drug, whether that's to be expected or was common or not.
We're going to need to take a short break. But we're going to continue this really interesting question of the patient perspective on cancer care, new drugs, and the whole patient experience. We're talking with Dr. Ethan Bash, and we'll be right back. Stay with us. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Ethan Bash from the UNC Cancer Hospital and Limburger Cancer Center, oncologist, about the patient experience in cancer and new drug development. And Dr. Bash, it brings to mind for me, I had a close relative die of pancreatic cancer not too long ago, and we used a medication called gemcitabine. And the difficulty of knowing, was this the right drug? We knew that it might prolong his life, but it was really hard to know, well, was this going to help him have quality of life? And I'll be honest with you, even as a family doctor, I was a little lost. How do we think about things like this?
Yeah, you know, I think that it's a great example, because this is a case where there's a drug for a terrible disease that can prolong life a very small amount. And this is really quite common in oncology, that drugs are approved that may prolong life on average by a few weeks. But they have a lot of side effects. They have a lot of toxicities. And people want to know about how their quality of life will be affected. And I, as a clinician, want to be able to talk about that with my patients. And unfortunately, this information is often absent. And so we're relying on anecdote, on my own experience, what my colleagues have told me, my guesses. And this really puts me and my patients in a difficult position. I think it makes it very hard for patients to make a decision when they have incomplete information, because quality of life is so important. One of the things that compelled this article that you mentioned is that in the United States, the FDA will not look at quality of life information. They regard it as being too general and not specific enough, and they don't think that it's research quality grade information. But many of us in oncology research and who are clinicians understand that quality of life is one of the most important things you can understand. It's very surprising, and that's one of the reasons that there's been a bit of a movement behind this to change the way things are done.
And so why is that? So the FDA has put some emphasis in symptoms and other things in non-cancer medicines that we can see what are common side effects, sometimes too much information on every little side effect, but very little in the way of cancer drugs. Is that part of that global, it's too soft, or what do you think that's really about?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things. It's a great question. So as far as the quality of life issue specifically, that's beyond cancer. Within the FDA in the United States, there's a resistance to considering the concept of quality of life in drug development and drug approval, because it's not clear what contributes to quality of life changes. So it's thought of as being multifactorial. You're not sure if it's the pain or the fatigue or the nausea or the inconvenience of the drug.
It's hard to measure.
It's hard to know. And, you know, it's understandable if one is a regulator and wants to be very specific about what's causing something to change, that one might focus on something more like pain. But the second thing is that oncology seems to be a special case, because even though many drugs are approved based on symptom information, for example, a pain medicine is obviously approved based on how people's pain is affected, in cancer drug development, we simply don't include the information when we're doing the trials, because we have become so focused on survival and so focused on things like measuring tumor response with CAT scans or PET scans. It's historical, it's cultural, it's the way that things are done, but it's led us to this point where drugs are approved and we simply don't understand their impact on how people feel.
Well, so we take the feelings out of medicine, and yet when you have a patient in front of you and you do a lot of your clinical work with prostate cancer, how do you have a conversation when you hear a patient say, how will this make me feel, when there's not a clear answer? And I'm sure there's some examples within the prostate cancer treatment field. How do you respond, and what advice do you give?
Sure. You know, I can give you a specific example. There's a brand new drug that there was a lot of excitement about. It was just approved over the past year in prostate cancer. It's a pill. It's easy to take. I was actually involved with the clinical trials that developed this product, and I and others were very excited. And the information from the study suggested that it was extremely well tolerated. The people felt fantastic, almost felt no side effects. And I can tell you now that I have patients being treated, that's really not the case. People feel tired, they have nausea, they have some GI side effects, and it's actually kind of bothersome to some people. You have the situation where a drug comes out, we think we understand how people are going to feel, we tell people how they might expect to feel, but then they feel differently. And that causes a lot of problems. The first thing is we don't adequately prepare people for what they might experience, either informationally or in terms of, say, other supportive things that we could do to help them out with those side effects. But also, it really undermines the authority of the clinician that we have incomplete information or, you know, that we may be misguiding our patients. So it creates some difficulties.
Is there a reporting process? If we gave a new immunization, we'd have to report any adverse side effects at all. Is there a reporting process with these medications to report that they're feeling these side effects?
Well, you know, if you think about it, you know, we're all patients one time or another, and we all take various therapies, and we all feel things all the time, but we're not reporting that stuff. Mm-hmm. That is a lost opportunity, right? Especially these days when we've all become so accustomed to reporting all kinds of information about all kinds of things, it's unfortunate that we don't take advantage of the experiences that we all have. And to answer your question, there really isn't.
The other question that comes to mind is you've exposed in your article and in this conversation a pretty big blind spot in the way of cancer medication development. What needs to happen? Like now you've exposed it, you're bringing this to light, but what's it going to take to change this?
Yeah, it's a great question. There are two pieces to it. There's a cultural piece and there's a very practical logistical piece. The latter is a little easier to change. Really what has to happen is that the FDA reviewers, when they meet with representatives of drug companies, have to explicitly note that they feel as regulators that they will have an incomplete understanding of the properties of a particular drug unless they understand how it makes people feel. And it's not until the FDA starts to do that the drug companies will respond, because the drug companies, even though they may be well-intentioned, are very pragmatic and they respond to what they're asked to do. But I think there's a second piece to it, which is that the drug companies themselves have to understand that this is very important information for them to gather so that they will understand how people taking these products are going to feel. And it's actually to their advantage to do that. For example, there's increasing data that people stop taking their medications because of side effects, particularly symptomatic side effects. Mm-hmm. And if a drug company doesn't understand those side effects, it may have an impact on their ability to sell their drug. The second thing, though, is that in the current healthcare environment, drug companies increasingly have to cater to the needs of the insurance companies, not just the regulators like the FDA. And that's a real change. And the insurance companies actually care quite a bit about how people feel. Because when people feel poorly, they use more services, and that costs the insurance company more money. And so there's been this shift now because the stakeholders are changing, and the drug companies really need to understand that to meet the informational needs of the insurance companies, they need to measure how people feel upfront, way at the beginning during drug development.
You know, I think in our remaining moments, we're talking with Dr. Ethan Bash from the University of North Carolina Cancer Hospital about his experience as an oncologist helping patients understand the potential real side effects and really develop this process. What would be your recommendations in our remaining few seconds here about if you have patients or patients out there and listening and loved ones, how do they have this conversation, perhaps with their oncologist who may or may not have the same orientation that you have? What do you advise?
I think that patients need to know that it's okay to ask their clinician about how they're going to feel, and to ask, you know, if it's not known. I think it's important to stay in close communication with the clinician.
Thank you so much for advocating for our patients and standing up for what's right as we develop new drugs.
Thank you for being our guest today.
Thank you very much. Pleasure being here.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have a question you'd like Christy and I to address on an upcoming show, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And Christy, we have a variety of House Call questions today, ranging from patients with low back pain and what they call back mice,
to constipation with traveling,
to really, does it matter if you control your high blood pressure and diabetes? Is that going to really help you?
And with bug bites in the summer and ways to prevent them.
Well, let's listen our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, if you can read us our very first House Call today.
I went to see my doctor for some low back pain I get periodically. She felt my back and said I have back mice. They were really painful, and she injected me with lidocaine, and the pain went away. Wow. Have you ever heard of these?
Back mice. Well, these aren't the type of mice that are just kind of running up and down your back, and they're, you know, rats and mice. Not those type of mice necessarily.
But, and honestly, I have to say, I was a resident physician when I first heard the term back mice, and I did not believe it. But there is literature, some of it done by our own Dr. Peter Curtis, who is a former faculty member in our department, about these fibrofatty nodules that are called back mice.
Yeah, and what happens is when you feel them for the first time, they kind of like skirt underneath your fingers. Like you think you have them, and then they're gone. And you move, then they move around. And so they're kind of like in about the size of a small mouse. And they're incredibly painful when you touch them. And sometimes you think someone has low back pain from a disc disease, but then you see these little mice in their back, and you touch them, and they're painful, and they move around, and you go, ah, they've got back mice.
Well, and it's very satisfying from the physician standpoint that when we find this and can offer an injection in the back, that it often does make a difference. And then, you know, there are lots of back pain that we just have to say, sorry, here are some medicines to deal with it. But this is one of those that sometimes we can really do something about it.
And it's the injection with the lidocaine. The lidocaine itself doesn't really treat it, but it does numb it up so you can tolerate someone sticking a needle in the back. But it's thought that the needle punctures these fibrofatty nodules and releases whatever buildup of tissue and gas that may be in there, and they dissolve literally right in front of you, and you pass four or five passes with the needle. They're not very deep, and you break them up, and patients can walk out of the office literally without much pain. So if your doctor says you got fibrofatty nodules, you say, I've got some back mice.
See if you can get an injection. Let's take our next House Call question. That was a good one.
I seem to be constipated when I travel, particularly when I travel overseas. Is there anything I can do to prevent this?
Well, you could avoid traveling.
No.
Oh, no, that's not an empathetic statement. No,
we want you to travel.
And we know that when you sit there for a long time and don't do physical activity, you can get constipated.
And a lot of times if you're in an airplane, you can become more dehydrated. So it's certainly something that you can do something about by drinking more water, by trying to take in more fruits and vegetables, perhaps more fiber than you normally take in, by moving around.
And sometimes people will take medicines to help them move their bowels. Laxative is another thing. So it's not our first choice, second choice, but it is sometimes a third choice there. Lots of ways to really prevent this, knowing that your diet's going to change. Sometimes you go to places where the diet causes you to have increased bowel movements, and we sometimes worry about that as well. It can happen even if you travel within the United States. It doesn't even have to be overseas, unfortunately.
That's true. So focus on your water and your fiber and maybe a stool softener and movement, and hopefully you can prevent that the next time you travel.
And be careful. Some of the medicines sometimes people take for traveling for motion sickness can have medicines in them that actually can be constipating.
Like
even
Dramamine.
Some of Dramamine or some of the sleep medicines sometimes have side effects causing constipation. Ask your doctor before you start taking new medicines when you're traveling overseas.
Good point. Let's take our very next House Call question.
If I have high blood pressure and diabetes for 20 years, but I really control my blood pressure and blood sugar with medications, can I prevent strokes from occurring?
Well, that's a really good question because I think we as doctors feel that if we could just get all of our patients to quit smoking and control their high blood pressure and lose weight and lower their blood sugars, we could prevent things like heart attacks and strokes.
And the truth is that you and we can reduce your risk by having you have that blood pressure in control, your cholesterol, keeping good blood sugar control, taking a baby aspirin, not smoking. But we can't totally reduce that risk to zero. It still could happen, but we can make it less likely by paying attention to all of those factors.
The other thing that is important is that we might actually lower that risk, and the stroke, if you had one, might not be a large stroke. It might be these mini strokes, in which case then we focus on also maybe getting your cholesterol lower and thinning out that blood. So you're really working with your doctor here. And so when we say your hemoglobin A1C, that 3-month average blood sugar is too high, take us seriously. Ask us what you can do to get it to be normal, because that lowers your risk.
That's a really great question, and one that, you know, you can do the very best you can with all of these things, and then that is the best you can do. There are lots of unknowns in life, and that's a little scary, but it sounds like you're paying attention to it and working with your doctor to do those things to reduce your risk. So congratulations.
Erica, what's our very last house call?
In the summer, I ended up with way more mosquito bites than the rest of my household, and I use the same protectants. Why are they attracted to me, and what can I do to decrease these bites?
Oh, I feel for you.
You're more attracted to the mosquitoes. That's a bottom line, unfortunate thing.
It is sad, and especially when everyone else is like, what mosquitoes? And you're getting bit up and have all these welts all over. And it's really
that's
hard.
Because they're going to you rather than me. Are you a high mosquito attractant, Christy?
I am. My mother always told me growing up that I just had such sweet blood that the mosquitoes wanted to
eat. You're an HMA, a high mosquito attractant. I'm a LMA, I'm a low mosquito attractant. And the reality is that there are different skin types that people have. Some people are really sensitive. They get real big boils almost when they get bites versus others who get very anything. And some people's skin emits the odors that are attractive, certain oils and the heat and ways that are attractive to the mosquitoes, and some people's don't. And unfortunately, that part can't be changed, but it can be changed. The things that repel them should work still.
Sure. So the repellents that have DEET in them or permethrin can be helpful, wearing long sleeves and pants, paying attention to those early evening hours and putting on some sort of protectant before they start biting you. Those types of things can be helpful to reduce your suffering. I'm sorry for you.
Some people will fog their outdoor areas. Those have chemicals in them, not my favorite, particularly for the environment and pets. Others will get these mosquito things that collect them through carbon dioxide and certain chemicals that attract the mosquitoes, and they get through a jet and they collect them in different ways. It's an increasing problem. We're going to hear more about it. But thank you for that question. And thank goodness that mosquito season's almost over. Can't wait for that first frost.
I know. Well, this gives us a chance to talk about mosquitoes and talk about reducing strokes,
about travel-related constipation, and hopefully you don't have that, or diarrhea.
And about fibrofatty nodules in your back called back mice.
Well, thank you for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you and your health. And you can send your own questions to us at yourhealth@unc.edu or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, on iTunes, where you can get our health app by searching Your Health, one word, for a free download.
We'd like to thank the University of North Carolina Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship. Our guest today, Dr. Ethan Bosch, and we hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.